It's Thursday and time to read from your letters.
Professor William Beeman of Brown University writes to point out a historic parallel between this past weekend's election in Iraq and a vote in South Vietnam in the late 60s. He included this clip from an article in the New York Times, which is making the rounds on the Internet.
Washington, September 3rd, 1967. United States officials were surprised and heartened today at the size of turnout in South Vietnam's presidential election, despite a Viet Cong terrorist campaign to disrupt the voting. According to reports from Saigon, 83% of the 5.85 million registered voters cast their ballots yesterday. Many of them risked reprisals threatened by the Viet Cong. Later, the article states, a successful election has long been seen as the keystone in President Johnson's policy of encouraging the growth of constitutional processes in South Vietnam.
On to comments about my interview with Peter Bernstein, author of Wedding of the Waters, The Erie Canal and the Making of a Great Nation.
How disheartening to hear NPR chanting the mantras of manifest destiny with such a straight face.
This is from Patricia Longo of Honolulu, Hawaii.
She continues, does calling the building of the Erie Canal part of the making of a great nation stop it from being part of the rape of a great continent? I'm sure that chopping away the ancient forest to create the modern Northeast was indeed a daunting task, as Peter Bernstein put it on your show. But slowing down the ongoing destruction of our planet today is proving to be even more daunting. The situation is made worse when intelligent people like yourselves can consider the Northeast U.S. and romanticize its creation so uncritically.
Others write to highlight impressive feats of canal building not mentioned by Peter Bernstein. Tom Schudick of Burbank, California, reminds us that in 17th century France, construction of a 10-meter-wide canal stretching 240 kilometers from the Garonne River to the Mediterranean was begun. The Canal du Midi travels up and down the Languedoc by means of a series of locks which are filled by runoff diverted from the surrounding mountains. And William Holmes of Ashfield, Massachusetts, writes that China's Grand Canal is much longer than the Erie at 1,000 miles, and it was built in sections over some 2,000 years.
Finally, your thoughts on our story about an often overlooked part of the rock and roll sound, the cowbell.
Yesterday, commentator Mitch Myers fondly recalled its prominence in the hard rock of the 1970s music by groups such as Blue Oyster Cult, Grand Funk Railroad, and Mountain.
Last night, you hit a new low, writes Judy Bent of Fort Collins, Colorado. You have a literate audience that is engaged with the world. Why on earth would you think we are interested in the history of cowbells in rock music? I suspect you have a marketing person telling you how to attract a younger audience. In case you're interested, I thought I'd let you know that you're losing a percentage of the rest of us.
J.J. Tyndall of Chicago writes in to point out an error some of you heard in Mitch Myers' piece. That's not Charlie Watts playing cowbell on the Stones' Honky Tonk Women, he informs us. It's producer Jimmy Miller.
And finally, Gary Stutz from Edmonds, Washington, sent this.
As a garage band veteran from the late 60s, I must point out that your reviewer missed the seminal cowbell song. It's Time Has Come Today by the Chambers Brothers. The attenuated frequency response in my left ear, caused by standing next to our drummer's enthusiastic version, is a living reminder of the power of the cowbell.
Well, Gary, you might want to back away from your radio, because here it is.
I think we can safely say that's a song with enough cowbell.
Maybe. We'd like to hear from you. Write to us at atc@npr.org. Please tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.